Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith. The Reformation set the church on a new course based on the Bible. Martin Luther, Ulrich Zwingli, and John Calvin. These were the movement's leaders during the 1500s. Today, we meet John Calvin. From the Moody Church in Chicago, this is Running to Win with Dr. Erwin Lutzer, whose clear teaching helps us make it across the finish line. Dr. Lutzer is nearing the end of a series on the Reformation, the great return to the Scriptures as our basis of faith, a revolution begun by Martin Luther in 1517.
As you may know, this is my fourth message in a series on the Reformation. And the first was on Martin Luther, the doctrine of justification. The second was on Luther and the sacraments and what it really meant for Luther to say that the Scripture alone was the Word of God and should be followed. And then, of course, there was a third message on the Anabaptist movement, I think probably the most important in the series. And if you missed any of those, or if you're listening by radio and you caught only snatches of those messages, I really urge you to buy the whole set of four, because this will make the fourth of two cassettes with two messages on each cassette. And this will give you more comprehensive context in which to understand the Reformation. Now, as you may have guessed, my own preference would be to preach about 10 messages on the Reformation. But I do feel that that would be overkill, and I would much rather have you thirsting for more than having someone tell me that you've received too much. So consequently, this will be the last message. When Martin Luther walked that nearly one half mile from the university in Wittenberg and posted his 95 theses on the door of the castle church, John Calvin was a boy of about 8 years old, grown up, living there in France, a very precocious, brilliant child. At the age of 14, he entered into the University of Paris and later on the University of Orleans to study law. It was in university that he came in contact with the writings of Luther and was impressed by those writings and also the writings of humanists. And consequently, he began to imbibe himself in ideas that were foreign to the established church in France. Sometime after that, through his study of the Scriptures and the reading of others, Calvin was converted. He came to saving faith in Jesus Christ. And then in 1536, at the age of about 27, he went to Basel, Switzerland. Now, the reason for that was because there was persecution of the Protestants in France. And in order to escape what was happening in France, he went to Basel, Switzerland, and there he wrote a book entitled The Institutes of the Christian Religion. Now, the Institutes was dedicated to the King of France because Calvin said, I want the King of France to understand what Protestantism is really teaching. And that book, written with such clarity and such commitment to the Scriptures, became instantly recognized throughout Europe as a standard textbook on Reformed theology. You've heard of Reformed theology. That's it, Reformed theology. And it became the book that was used for at least 200 years after Calvin as the standard textbook on Christian theology. Later on, he revised it, and it became a little longer. My edition that I have at home comes in two volumes, and when you add the pages together, it is something like a total of about 1,300 or 1,400 pages. You say, well, is that all that Calvin wrote? My friend, no, that is not all that Calvin wrote. Calvin wrote commentaries on most of the books of the Bible. People wrote to him throughout Europe, and he always answered and gave replies. And so if you see today a complete writing, or all the writings of Calvin, I should say, comprises 57 volumes. 57 volumes. It is said that even when Calvin was ill, and he was very frequently ill, he was very frail, he was very skinny. Even when Calvin was ill, sometimes he would keep four secretaries busy dictating to them both in French and as necessary also in Latin. He was a brilliant man. In order for you to understand a little better the influence that Calvin had, I must first of all tell you a story, and then we will speak about the great impact that this man had. Calvin fled to Basel, and then one day he was also going to Geneva. Now, you must understand that the northern Switzerland is German. That's where Zurich is. That's where Zwingli preached in German. But southern Switzerland is French, and that's where Calvin was visiting one day in Geneva, and he was staying at an inn. And by then he was already famous because he had written the Institutes, which were instantly recognized as a systematized treatment of Reformed theology. He was staying there, and a man by the name of Farel, who had gone to Zurich, or I should say gone to Geneva, met him. Now, Farel was a flaming, hot-tempered, rather direct kind of a prophet, sometimes compared to the prophet Elijah of the Old Testament. And Farel had just won a great victory in Geneva. See, in those days, whether a town went Catholic or Protestant was pretty well determined by the town council. The town council would hold a disputation, and then they would vote. Are we going to be Catholic or are we going to be Protestant? And Farel had held a disputation, and Geneva chose to be Protestant. Now, you understand that during those days, as you have the medieval structure breaking up, many people would flee from Geneva to another city if they were Catholic, or they would go from another city to Geneva if they were Protestant. They would move. But Farel knew that there was no way that he could organize Geneva or keep it Protestant unless he had help. And he urged Calvin to stay. And Calvin said no, because Calvin was someone who was shy. He was not given to publicity. And Farel said to him, if you don't stay, the curse of God is going to be on your life. And Calvin, out of fear, stayed in Geneva and spent the rest of his life there, with the exception of 3 years when he and Farel were exiled to Strasbourg because of some problems that had arisen in Geneva with the decision that they made to excommunicate some people from the church. But before I tell you about Calvin's theology, I want you to grasp the impact that Calvin has had in the history of the Christian church. For example, there in Geneva, he established this Protestant stronghold that we'll talk about in just a moment. But what happened was, in England, when you have the Reformation beginning to take hold and Bloody Mary began to behead all the Protestants, many of them fled to Geneva because they knew that Geneva was Protestant and it would give them refuge there, and they had heard of Calvin. And there they stayed in Geneva. Among them was one whose name was John Knox, a fiery preacher from Scotland. He came and he learned from Calvin. He did all that he could to absorb what was happening there in Geneva. And then he went back and, through Parliament, made Scotland Protestant. And could I say to you that Scotland became the most Calvinistic country in all of the world, in all of Europe? And then you not only have the influence of Calvin in Scotland, you have the influence of Calvin in Holland. All of Holland went with a Calvinistic Reformation, and other parts of Europe. It is impossible for us to understand the full impact of this, but think, for example, of the Puritans. Who were the Puritans? My friend, the Puritans were Calvinists. You see, they had gone to England, or they had lived there in England, and they had hoped to reform the English church, something like Calvin was reforming Geneva, and they failed. And of course, they differed with Calvin in the sense that they believed much more strongly in freedom of religion and freedom of conscience. But their theology was thoroughly Calvinistic, received, of course, from the Institutes of the Christian Religion written by Calvin. You've heard of the Puritans and their Geneva Bible. What's the Geneva Bible? Well, you see, when English people went from England to Geneva for refuge there and met with Calvin, They got together and they made an English translation of the Bible, which was printed in many, many different editions, and apparently I think there are still some of them that are visible today in museums. But that was why it was called the Geneva Bible. And the Puritans came to the United States convinced and thoroughgoing Calvinists. You look at the history of America, it was based on Calvinistic theology. Then, of course, we think of the great revivalists in the United States, the Whitfield, Jonathan Edwards, and others. All of these were thoroughgoing Calvinists in their theology. It is not too much to say that every one of us, whether we are Calvinistic or not, have been influenced by Calvin because of his great input into the lives of people that touched so many different countries. Now, what is it, though, that Calvin believed? First of all, his doctrine of the church, which is one that some of us, I think, would strongly disagree with. He believed that just as God had a church in the Old Testament, which he called Israel, God has a church today, and that is called the church, and therefore what the church today should do is reconstruct the same kind of theocracy that they had in Old Testament times. And that's what he tried to do there in Geneva. He believed that since Geneva was going to go Protestant, he should use the town councils and the authorities that were present to make sure that everyone who lived in Geneva made a pledge to commitment to the Protestant faith. And then he began to try to run Geneva along the lines of a dictatorial Protestant enclave. For example, he taught such things as that you would have a penalty that would be exacted from you if you would go to a fortune teller. Now, that may not be all bad. You can't do that in a free society, but Calvin understood right well that people should not be doing that. But today it would be unthinkable that someone would be penalized because they go to a fortune teller, and probably there were none right there in Switzerland, right in Geneva, because Calvin made everyone want to be obedient, supposedly, to the Protestant faith, but that's the kind of a city that Calvin tried to run. Taverns were abolished. Parents could not have their children christened with the name of Catholic saints. Catholics were allowed to stay in Geneva if they kept their mouths shut and did not cause any trouble. But you see, Calvin bought into the medieval notion that the secular powers also should be of help in terms of instituting the law of God on earth. And that's why there is a blot on Calvin's history that is known by almost everyone, and that is the burning of Servetus at the stake because he denied the Trinity. Servetus had come from Spain. He did not believe in the Trinity. He went to France, and in France, the authorities there, the Roman Catholic authorities, were fixing to have him burned. So he fled to Geneva thinking for sure that in Protestant Geneva he would be exempt from the torture and the death that awaited him in France, only to discover that there in Protestant Geneva he was put to death with Calvin's approval. Now, the decision was made by the town council. It was thoroughly thought through. Calvin spent hours with Servetus trying to get him to recant, to see the error of his ways. But when he would not do that, in the end, it is true that Servetus was burned at the stake. And many people who don't know anything about Calvin know two things about him. They say, number one, under his authority, Servetus was burned at the stake. And number two, he believed in predestination. Those are the two things that Calvin is known for. Now, could I say, in order to understand Calvin, he was a product of his times. You see, in those days, and if you did not get the last message that I preached on the Anabaptist movement, you must do that, because in those days it was believed that the church that was in power had the right to impose its doctrines on everyone, and if they did not agree, heretics could be taken care of, just as they were in the Old Testament. They were stoned or they were burned at the stake. You see, even the reformers were trying to hold on to two conflicting ideas of the church. On the one hand, they wanted a church that embraced everyone. Remember how I emphasized that talking about Anabaptists and Martin Luther and the conflict. They wanted a church that embraced everyone. Everyone was supposed to give allegiance to the faith. On the other hand, they understood full well that within that larger church, there was a nucleus of people who were truly saved. But nevertheless, they tried to hang on to both of those ideas of the church, and I think that they were wrong. I think that there's no way today, from the New Testament, we do not have a mandate to restructure society by getting into power and then imposing our beliefs, our distinctive Christian beliefs, on all of society. As you know, in fighting matters such as abortion and other issues where there is commonality with other people, that's a different matter. But the distinctive Christian beliefs, such as the Trinity, all of that must be voluntarily believed. But that's another story. Secondly, what did Calvin teach about baptism? Well, as you already know, Calvin also taught that infants should be baptized. But he differed from Luther because, as we learn, Luther said that infants are regenerated at baptism. Through the water, they are made children of God. Calvin believed that it was a sign of the covenant. Because the New Testament says nothing about infant baptism, I already mentioned to you that everybody is free to give it whatever meaning they wish. Calvin also wiggled around a little bit before he found a meaning that he was comfortable with. First of all, he said that it means that they have already been regenerated by God. And then he realized that if that was the case, if infants are regenerated by God, perhaps even at birth, they would not be born as being in Adam, but as already in Christ. And that did not work very well. But he did say that it was a sign of the covenant. Just as circumcision was a sign of the covenant in the Old Testament, so baptism is a sign of the covenant in the New Testament. Some people said that it was not for the benefit of the child that the baptism was taking place. It was for the benefit of the parents who are making a commitment. And there are all kinds of different interpretations and meanings that have been given to that. So much for Calvin on baptism. What about Calvinism in relationship to salvation? Now, you must understand, of course, that Calvin, his theology begins and ends with the greatness and the magnitude and the power of God. Whereas Luther began his theology by thinking about justification by faith, Calvin begins his theology by thinking of the grandeur and the immutability of the purposes of a sovereign God whose will was being accomplished upon the earth, regardless of human resistance. If you ever need some encouragement, you ought to read a little bit of Calvinism with regard to providence, for example. Calvin is talking about the contingency of human existence and how life is filled with all kinds of mishaps. He says, mount a horse. If one foot slips, your life is imperiled. Go through the city streets, and you are subject to as many dangers as there are tiles on the roofs. If there's a weapon in your hand or a friend's, harm awaits. All the fierce animals you see are armed for your destruction. That may not apply if you live in the city of Chicago, but it may apply on the Kennedy Expressway. But if you try to shut yourself up in a walled garden, seemingly delightful, there a serpent may lie hidden. Your house is continually in danger of fire. It threatens in the daytime to impoverish you, at night to collapse on you. Your field, since it is exposed to hail, frost, drought, and other calamities, threatens you with barrenness and hence famine. He says, I pass over poisonings, ambushes, robberies, open violence, which in part besiege us at home and abroad. Amid these tribulations, must not man be most miserable, since but half alive in life, he weakly draws his anxious and languid breath as if he had a sword perpetually hanging over his neck. My word almost wants to cause us to wonder whether we're going to make it through the morning service, doesn't it? What does Calvin have to say about this? What he says is that believers can be exempt from the anxiety that accompanies these contingencies if they recognize that back behind it all was the sovereign purpose and the will of God, who knows better than we do and under whose wings we have come to trust. You see, Calvin understood something more clearly than many, perhaps, that when God permits something, It really means that God wills that it happens. Let's take, for example, the tornado that took place outside of Chicago, out west here, what was it, about a year ago. Christians say, well, the tornado possibly was the work of the devil who is involved in weather. That may be a possibility. I'm not sure exactly to what extent he is involved, but maybe, because after all, we live in a fallen world. But we would all agree as Christians that God permitted the tornado to happen. Calvin would respond and say, does not this mean that God could have chosen to not permit it to happen? Does not permission imply that indeed God willed that it happened? Because God could have simply said, don't happen, and it wouldn't have happened. So when he was talking to people who were about to be beheaded for their faith and all of the activity that frequently went with the persecutions, here's a word of comfort from Calvin. He said, let them, that is people who are assailed by Satan, and some of you are working in business establishments where somebody has it out for you and they're trying to lay traps in your way, and they're trying to make life miserable. Let such people recall that the devil and the whole cohort of the wicked are completely restrained by God's hand as by a bridle, so that they are unable either to hatch any plot against us, or, having hatched it, to make preparations about it, or if they have prepared for it and have planned it, they cannot stir a finger toward carrying it out, except so far as God has permitted, indeed, commanded it. Wow.
Well, you know, this is Pastor Luther, and once again, I want to say, wow. When you think of the Protestant Reformation, you think of Luther, you think of Calvin, who I have just been speaking about, and then you think of Zwingli. They are the three great reformers. They were not perfect. As a matter of fact, isn't it wonderful that God doesn't use perfect people? He has to put up with the imperfect ones, namely all of us. I've written a book about the Reformation entitled Rescuing the Gospel. It discusses all three reformers, particularly Luther. And as we read it, we will be inspired to defend the faith once delivered to the saints.
500 years ago, a German monk named Martin Luther saw abuses in the church he could no longer tolerate.
So in anger, he sat down and he wrote 95 theses for the purpose of debate, and he walked now from the university, which we visited, down the narrow street to the castle church, and in anger put those 95 theses on the church door where people would walk by and see them.
And see them they did.
Luther did not know that night on October 31st, 1517, that he was starting a revolution that would have such incredible repercussions that there's not one single person listening to me by way of radio or in this congregation who has not been affected by that act.
What began in Wittenberg changed Western history.
The simple fact is that some of the issues that the reformers faced are issues that we face today, that have to do with freedom of religion, issues such as the relationship of the church and state. I've written a book entitled Rescuing the Gospel, The Story and the Significance of the Reformation. I wrote it for the common person. That is to say, I believe that it is a readable account that will help us understand ourselves because we understand the past.
Rescuing the Gospel will be sent to you with our thanks for your gift of any amount to support Running to Win. For information, call right now at 1-888-218-9337. That's 1-888-218-9337. Or write to us at Running to Win, Moody Church, 1635 North LaSalle Boulevard, Chicago, Illinois, 60614. Online, reach us at rtwoffer.com. That's rtwoffer.com. To understand God, you need to master the fundamentals of theology. That's where John Calvin's legacy is invaluable. Next time on Running to Win, our series on the Reformation concludes. we'll learn more about Calvin's teachings. We hope you'll join us. This is Dave McAllister. Running to Win is sponsored by the Moody Church.